We're in Deuteronomy 21, and I think it's proper for people to wonder, what are we going to get out of this passage? Because it is so unusual. The Jewish culture, the Jewish society was significantly different. Of course, we're talking, this happened 1445 or so BC. This is a long time ago, 3,500 years ago. And their culture in the ancient Near East is significantly different from ours. And so, just like you, as I read the passage to begin with, beginning my study, I read it and I sometimes just shake my head and say, what am I going to say about this? Because it's so foreign to us. But as usually happens, okay, I read it through a few times and I start considering and thinking about it and I pick out some points here and there, and suddenly at the end of the week or at the end of my time of study by Saturday night, I've got way more information and way more things that I could say than I actually can say on a Sunday morning. So there are some things here that I think that we can learn, some timeless principles, once again, based on the principles that God gives to Moses. These are based on, for the most part, underlying these regulations are timeless principles that still apply to us today in sort of a general sense. So this chapter, as you maybe have noticed, as Devin read it a little while ago, it has five major points or five issues, five topics. One is finding a dead body in a field. The second one is taking a captive wife. The third is dealing with inheritance issues, and then dealing with a stubborn and rebellious son. And then it finishes up with hanging a dead body of a criminal on a tree. Now, most of us don't have anything to do with any of those, or at least most of those. That doesn't pertain to our everyday, daily life. But these are the regulations for Israel. And remember, Moses is talking about what they should do when they enter the promised land. They'll be doing that in just a few short weeks after, you know, we get done with Deuteronomy. Joshua takes off and they go into the promised land and they start the conquest. So this is how to live in the promised land. And obviously we're not in the promised land. We're the church. We're not the nation of Israel. We don't deal with these items or these topics very often. The one maybe that still pertains in more of a direct way is the inheritance issues, making sure that we have an inheritance to give to those who come after us. But the majority of these, finding a dead body in the field or dealing with a criminal who's been killed or what to do with a captive wife, you know, these are issues that we don't deal with. But, as I said, there are some underlying principles here, some timeless principles that we can still apply to ourselves today. And I think the text revolves around two major ideas. Notice verse 9. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you. That concept of putting away sin, putting away the evil. He says basically the same thing in verse 21, the second part of it. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. This idea of putting away the evil and doing what is right in these various circumstances of life. So likewise, all of us ought to be interested in doing that exact same thing. Put away the evil in our relationships, in the circumstances of life. We ought to be trying to live in a way that we get rid of or put away or dispense with the evil or the sin that might be part of those situations. We want to put away the evil and we want to do the right thing, do what is right in the sight of the Lord. So we don't face these exact same circumstances, but in the difficulties of life, in the hard situations, when we are facing difficulties in life, maybe it's a family issue. Most of these things have to do with family issues or issues of life and death. What should we be wanting to do? I want to put away the evil, that is, not get involved in the evil behavior or attitudes that could be involved with these circumstances. I want to put that away and do what is right. Always be seeking to do what is right in God's sight. That we can certainly apply to virtually any circumstances of life that we face. So let's go through these then and look at, first of all, do what is right in God's sight regarding human life. Human life seems to be the first thing that he's mentioning here, because he talks about finding a corpse in a field. Again, look at verse 1. If anyone is found slain, lying in the field, in the land which the Lord your God is giving to you to possess, and it is not known who killed him. Okay, so the scenario, the first case, involves finding a dead body in a field. Now, I don't know how many of you have found a dead body in a field, but it's not something that happens very often. But, again, in the promised land, under these circumstances, it clearly could happen. And so Moses tells the people then what to do. The assumption here is that the murder occurred. It's probably not a dead body who just, you know, the guy had an accident or something. The assumption, I think, here is that there is crime. There's a sin involved with the death of this guy, but they didn't know who did it. It says here that they did not see it. They don't know. They don't know who the murderer is, but they assume that it must be somebody nearby. Because notice it says in verses 2 and 3, your elders and your judges shall go and measure the distance to the slain man to the surrounding cities, and it shall be that the elders of the city nearest the slain man will go on to do something else. Okay, so they assume that probably the guy who committed the murder is from that area, or at least the dead guy must be from that area. So the people of the city, the elders and people from the city nearest to the where the dead body was found, they're the ones who have to deal with this. The whole procedure assumes that the guilt of innocent blood would be upon the people and the land if they didn't do something about this. They couldn't just ignore it. They had to do something about it. It's similar to, if you found a dead body in the field, what would you do? Ignore it? Probably you'd call 911, or you'd call somebody, probably the police, to come and deal with the situation. Well, we're instructed here to do something when something like this happens. We are responsible to take care of a situation that would be our responsibility. Now, what do they do about it? Well, a very interesting set of events here has to happen. Verse 3, the elders from the people nearest the slain man would take a heifer, which has not been worked and which has not pulled a yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to the valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Now again, to our ears, that sounds really weird. Killing a perfectly innocent animal in a valley that has not been cultivated. Why would they have to do that? Well, they're doing an act of atonement. They're paying for the death of the individual. You know that the soul that sins, it shall die. The criminal was not caught. He deserves capital punishment. And so in the eyes of God, somebody has to pay that price. A substitute has to pay the price for the fact that a murder was committed. A murder is a heinous act against God because it blots out the image of God in a human. So somebody has to pay the price. Their atonement has to be made. And so the life of this innocent animal is taken for the life of the criminal who really should be taken. His life ought to be taken. But since nobody knows who the murderer is, well, then they have to kill this animal. And it's done in an uncultivated valley, and it's done to an animal that is innocent in a certain sense. That is, he's not pulled the plow. Somebody said the fact that the animal and the field have never been worked suggests that they were undefiled, having neither been ritually contaminated by humans. Just like in the sacrificial time, when they sacrificed a lamb, it had to be an unblemished lamb. So in order to stand for, to take away the guilt of the sin for the person who committed the murder, in order to atone for that sin, the animal had to be unworked. So this is what we call substitutionary atonement. We find the substitutionary nature of the atonement from the very beginning of the Bible and all the way through. This is an innocent victim dying for the guilty sinner. And notice that the men kill the heifer by breaking its neck. Now, normally speaking, in the sacrificial system, how did they kill the animal? I mean, it's kind of graphic, but they slit the throat and they bleed the animal because they're going to manipulate the blood. They're going to use the blood. The life of the flesh is in the blood, and they have to take that blood and sprinkle it and do various things in the sacrificial system. But this is not part of the sacrificial system. This is a death for the atonement to atone for, you might say, this murder that's occurred. So there's no sprinkling of the blood. There's no sacrificial taking of the blood. It's just the life of the animal that is taking. The animal died in place of the unknown criminal who deserved to die. And then notice what the priests do here, verse 5. The elders of the city nearest the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. We don't know who the murderer was. We have nothing to do with it, and we're going to wash our hands of it, as it were, showing their innocence. I didn't do it. We don't know who did it. The murderer got away, and nobody knows who did it. So they're saying, we are not responsible for the blood of this person. This atonement, the death of this animal, should cover or should satisfy God. The payment has been made. The life of this animal has been taken, and thus God should be satisfied. He stands as a substitute for the death of the murderer. They pray then that the Lord would provide atonement in verse 8. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. And atonement shall be provided on the behalf for the blood that was shed by the murderer. So the atonement is necessary to pay for the blood guiltiness. This murderer committed a heinous act of sin, and God would hold the people and even the land responsible or accountable for the fact that they allowed this to happen. And so, because they didn't know who the murderer is, they killed this animal on his behalf, on behalf of the life of the murderer, and God then is appeased, or God is atoned. God is satisfied with that. The atonement is a price that is paid to satisfy a debt. And so this is what happens. God is atoned, or the sin is atoned for. God is satisfied with this. This then clears up the matter and settles it. God, notice, he's doing right in verse 9. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. So here's a difficult case. Nobody knows who the murderer is, but there is a sense in which you can take care of it. You can kill this animal, make atonement for it, and thus you are doing what is right in God's sight. The murderer deserved capital punishment, but they couldn't find him, so this substitute dies in his place. Now, in this case, they weren't able to do capital punishment. The murderer deserves capital punishment, but he got off. He ran away, and nobody knows who he was. So they had to kill this animal. But this shows the significance of capital punishment in the case of homicide or murder. Now today there's lots of controversy over capital punishment, but there really shouldn't be, at least not among Christians. We can understand in our government and other people who don't hold Christian values, they might not be in favor of capital punishment. But it is a biblical idea. No matter what we think of it in our world today or from our perspective, capital punishment is the right thing to do. It goes way back to Genesis chapter 9, where it first establishes the importance of capital punishment. We see it here, that capital punishment should have happened. They can't kill the murderer, so they kill somebody in his place. We even find that in the New Testament, that the government holds the sword, not in vain, because they have the right to take life in some situations. So we would hold the reality and the necessity of capital punishment. It should be done. It should be done in a fair and right way. But still, capital punishment is biblical. It's right and proper for murderers to lose their life. They have shed innocent blood, and that forfeits their own life. And so that's an important consideration. Let's skip then to another similar situation at the end of the chapter. We'll take care of these two dead bodies, or two situations that deal with dead bodies here at the same time. Verses 22 and 23. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, okay, so he's committed a crime, capital crime, he's going to be put to death. It says, he is put to death, and you shall hang, and you hang him on a tree. If you do that, if that happens, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day. So you shall not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving to you as an inheritance, for he who is hanged is accursed of God. So here we have another dead body. This is not a dead body just found in the field. This was a dead body that was, well, capital punishment was imposed upon this person, so he lost his life. If they desire, if they put that body on a tree to be exposed, to show, this would be a public example or an example of public execution. Why would they put that body on a tree? Well, to expose it to shame and ridicule, no doubt, but also to show what happens to a criminal. Public execution was, for probably thousands of years, the normal thing that would happen in a society. They would kill the criminal to show what happens to criminals. And although we don't do it typically here that way anymore, still in the ancient Near East and in that society, that was a very common thing to do. So that person is accursed of God because he's hung on a tree. And of course, that's the same passage that's used in the New Testament of Jesus. He's accursed of God because he's hung on a tree. They make reference to that very same passage. Well, the person who is killed like that deserves, even though he's a criminal, even though he's been exposed to public shame and ridicule as being hung on a tree, still he's supposed to be buried that same day. Because you don't want to expose the land to innocent blood. You don't want to have that dead body out there overnight. He's supposed to be buried this very same day. Well, we see several principles here as pertains to dealing with these two categories of dead bodies. First of all, we see that human life is valuable and precious. Why would there be these regulations if it didn't matter about human life or taking of human life or even what to do with a dead body? These things show the value of human life. We don't have to do these things with animals. We do these things with humans because we don't want to defile the land with innocent blood, and we want to make sure that we deal properly with things like dead bodies. Even a guilty criminal has to be buried. He may be stuck on a tree for a while, but at the end of the day, he has to be buried. Human bodies are important both in life and in death. And so valuing human life is right in God's sight. We're trying to put away the evil and do the right thing. So when it comes to human life, even human death, we have to try to do the right thing and do what is right in God's sight. Now, some of us in the future, even right now, we may deal with issues of death. What do we do with a dead body? Should we go through cremation? Should we bury it? The biblical pattern suggests burial is a good thing to do. Following the biblical pattern is burying that dead body. But everybody ought to be considering what would be the right thing to do, to put away the evil in my life and to do what is right. We ought to consider that. Whatever the situation is, especially pertaining to a dead body, our desire should be that we put away the evil and do the right thing. This also shows God has wrath against sin. The danger involved here is that God's wrath would fall on these people and even on the land if they ignored these regulations. They would be guilty of shedding of innocent blood. And so the atonement of the heifer effectively turned aside God's wrath. Hanging the criminal's body on a tree demonstrated God's wrath against sin. So we see both God's goodness here, because he provides atonement. You can find atonement for these sins. God is satisfied. There is atonement. But there's also God's wrath, the dealing with the criminal's body by hanging it on a tree, or the death of the heifer. These things show both God's goodness, his atonement, but also his wrath, the fact that this has to be paid for. We also see here that God is gracious. He provides a way to remove the guilt of sin, the guiltiness of bloodshed. That process involves substitutionary atonement. God is satisfied with the death of the animal. The murderer should die, but instead the animal dies. An innocent victim takes his place. God removes the pollution of sin through an adequate sacrifice. And so if we want to do the right thing, if we want to remove evil from among us, well, we have to value human life and avail ourselves of God's gracious offer of forgiveness. And of course, the picture here, as we go into the New Testament, what is the picture of substitutionary atonement? The innocent victim who dies for the sins of the people. Well, obviously, that's Jesus. His sacrifice on the cross was an atonement. It was a payment, an adequate sacrifice, an adequate payment for our sins. And we receive the benefits of that atonement through what? Repentance and faith. If we repent of our sins and ask God to forgive us, if we put our faith and trust in Jesus, then God will be atoned. Our sins are atoned. God is satisfied with the death of Christ as an adequate payment for our sins. So even as we look at this from 1,500 or so years before the time of Christ, we still see this payment of sin through an adequate sacrifice, that God is satisfied with that sacrificial atonement that is made, and God is satisfied with us as well if we put our faith in Christ. The second major category here is family issues. So after we get done with these dead bodies, now we go on to several family issues, where Moses gives us some instruction regarding different cases that could come up. We have three cases here that involve family life, particularly centering on children and wives. So these things, again, sometimes these things we see are tolerated under the Old Testament system, even though they're not ideal. Life sometimes can't be lived ideally in the perfect way. Sometimes there are things that God allows or tolerates that are not precisely the right way that it should be, but given the circumstances, we have to do what we can do. Given the circumstances, what should we try to do? Put away evil and do the right thing. So no matter what the circumstance is, and particularly with our family life, our desire ought to be that same thing. I don't know how to deal with these circumstances other than I have to try to get evil out of this, not sin, and try to do the right thing. And how we apply that in our individual circumstances may be different. But here are three cases. The first one pertains to a soldier taking a captive wife from among their defeated enemies. Now remember, this would not pertain to the Canaanites, because when they go into the promised land, and what are they supposed to do with the Canaanites? They're supposed to destroy them all. No marriages. In fact, Deuteronomy 7:3, you shall not make marriages with the Canaanites. So this is not that situation. This would be some other nation that they have some kind of conflict with in the promised land. This would be sometime after they settle in the promised land. Okay, so this is not that, not the Canaanite captives. But it could be the taking of captives in warfare would happen with the Israelites. This was a very common thing at that time. Remember that Israel is stationed between a bunch of very large nations. You've got Egypt to the south, you've got Assyria to the north, you've got the Babylonian kingdom. So all these kingdoms were warring and battling. You also have the Edomites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and Philistines. They were fighting all the time. So you can imagine that there might be conflict situations where either a large nation would sweep through that area, or there'd be a conflict between them and the Israelites and the Philistines or the Ammonites or the Edomites or the Moabites. These kinds of things happened all the time. And typically speaking, when another nation would defeat a city, they would take captives. The Israelites did that. Sometimes that happened to the Israelites. So this is a very common scenario. And Moses is saying, well, when that happens, here's what you could do. So what would happen if you were defeated? If your city was taken captive and you were among the captives, what would happen to you? Typically, you would either be sold into slavery or you'd be killed. Those are your two options. Now, which would be better? Would you rather be sold into slavery, where the potential would be that you might actually have a fairly nice life? Or would you rather be killed on the spot? Well, all things being equal, it'd probably be better, if you value your life, to be sold into slavery or taken captive by some nice guy, some nice person, a nice family who would not work you to death as a slave. So even though the situation here is not ideal for the captive people, still it's a lot better than what it could be. Other heathen nations would not treat their captives quite as nicely as what is described here. So we have to keep all that in mind. We see here that an Israelite soldier could marry a captive if he so desired. Again, that might seem rather unkind to us, but in reality, these regulations protect these women. Now, from a feminist point of view, they would look at this and say, this is total hogwash. This is very bad for the woman. But in reality, at this point, women were treated much like property. Women didn't have the right to vote or do much of anything else. In fact, you remember arranged marriages. Fathers would typically arrange the marriages for their daughters. And the daughter typically didn't have any say about it. The fathers would typically arrange things, and they would tell their daughter, okay, daughter, you're going to get married to this guy. Get ready. That's what's going to happen. And the daughter, frankly, didn't have much to say about it. So this was of a piece with that. This was very similar to that. A woman is captive, and she's taken by some guy who thinks that she's attractive and made to be his wife. So again, we would look at that and say this is tragic, but in reality, these are regulations that protect the woman and also limit the man to what he can do. Okay, so a captive wife actually had better conditions than other captives. And so, like I said, this protects the women captives and limits what the soldiers can do. Soldiers, as you might imagine, generally didn't treat captive women very well. You can imagine what would happen in a situation like that, especially with these heathen, pagan nations coming into various places and being victorious over cities. What would happen to the women in those situations? Well, we don't even want to think about it. They would not be treated very well. But these rules prevented the Israelite men from abusing women, and it allowed women at the same time to adjust to their new conditions. So it was really a more humane way of dealing with the results of warfare. So in this case, an Israelite man found a woman that he thought was attractive. Notice in verse 11, you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and would take her for your wife. So they have been victorious over a city, and among the captives, among those living captives, there's a beautiful woman, and one of the soldiers decides, hey, I'd like to take her for my wife. Well, there are certain regulations then. He could take this woman into his home. Notice verse 12. You shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. So there are several things that are supposed to happen here. The fellow, the soldier, takes the woman into his home, and she has to do some interesting things like shave her hair, trim her nails, and change her clothes, and given a month to mourn for her family. Again, these regulations prevented the Israelite man from doing abusive things to this woman because he couldn't just take her on the spot. You can imagine that other nations, the heathen and the wicked, would see a woman and they would do with her whatever they wanted to right away. In this case, the delay is at least a month, and the man has to take her as the wife. He can't just abuse her and let her go on her way. If he wants her, he has to take her as the wife. So as the wife, then, that would stipulate certain responsibilities that the man had toward this woman. He couldn't just abuse her and walk away. If he really wanted her, he had to take her as the wife. So that was protection for the woman. And the process would take at least a month. So the man had plenty of time to think this over. Did he really want to go through with this or not? So this was a delay to, again, protect the woman. After capturing the woman, the man had to treat her with civility and dignity. Now, probably the woman didn't really enjoy what was happening to her. After all, she's essentially taken as a slave. She has no say, no authority in this whole thing. But again, what are her options? She could be sold into slavery, she'd be killed, or could be killed. So this is not the worst thing that would happen to people at that time. And the Israelite soldier had to treat her with civility and a measure of dignity. She's allowed to mourn her parents. As it says, put off the clothes, remain in your house, mourn her father and mother a full month. So that seems to indicate that her mother and father had probably died in this battle for this city. So perhaps this woman didn't have father and mother. Maybe the rest of her family is dead. Maybe she's the only one who survived. We don't know. But she's given time to mourn, which is, again, treating this woman with some delicacy, treating her with some respect. Shaving her head, trimming her nails, and changing her clothes were meant to show that she's beginning a new life. And again, it's under kind of bad circumstances, but she has to recognize that her mother and father are probably dead. She's been taken captive. She's probably not going to go back to her old way of life. So she has to prepare herself to begin a new life, just like a bride, just like as if the father had given his daughter to some other guy. Well, she's got to prepare for a new life. And in this case, the woman, this captive, is treated similarly, where she has to prepare for a new life. It's not going to be the life that she expected, but it can be a good life if it's with a good Israelite man. So the Israelite soldiers could take this woman captive, but they could not abuse her in the various ways that a soldier typically would. The soldiers are restricted from dishonoring these women after they become captives. And so after this month's delay, then, he can take this woman as his wife. She didn't really have many options here. It doesn't say that the woman agreed to any of this. Again, she's taken captive, so she's not agreeing to any of this. But it's probably the best thing that could happen in a very bad situation. And that's what I mean, that sometimes life is like that. Life is not oftentimes the way that we hope or expected. Sometimes we go through bad situations and we can't do anything about it. So what do? We try to make the best of it. We try to say, I'm going to get rid of the sin in this situation, and I'm going to try to do what God tells me to do. I'm going to try to obey God, to please God in this situation, whatever it is. It's a bad situation. I can't do anything about it, but I can try to put away the evil and do the right thing. And that's essentially what's happening here. So this happens. You shall be the husband. She shall be your wife. Verse 14, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free, but you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. So given all the factors involved, you could certainly understand how a woman would not respond favorably to this. This woman might make the man's life terrible. She's not a good wife. She does not submit to him for various reasons. Maybe she doesn't take, you know, the Jewish faith. She doesn't want to live with this guy. She has great resentment toward him, great hatred of him, because he took her captive. And so you can understand that she might make this guy's life very bad. And so if he determines after marrying her that I really don't want this woman after all, she turns out to be a very bad wife, well, then he can set her free. The man could not treat her brutally because he's humbled her. She could go out as a free woman. So in other words, we would say that they get a divorce. That's not a positive thing, but in some cases, the termination of this relationship would be beneficial. The woman then goes out free. He can't sell her as a slave. She goes out free just like anybody else, and then she's free to remarry or do whatever she needs to do. This is certainly not an endorsement of divorce. We do find several places in the Old Testament where they have divorces. And typically speaking, you know, as the Bible says, God hates divorce. But there are certain circumstances in which it's necessary or it's tolerated or it's allowed. And here's one of those circumstances where the end of this relationship is allowed because of these factors. Again, we see how God values human life, even the life and needs of a conquered captive. This is a very vulnerable young woman, and she could be easily abused and mistreated. And yet God says you have to treat her with a degree of dignity and respect. Even in a very difficult set of circumstances, the man has to treat her with some respect and with some dignity. She's protected. The man is limited by what he can do. And so this protects the woman, a very vulnerable person in this situation. The second case pertains to dealing with inheritance issues. Notice verses 15 and following. If a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is the unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow the firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. So this again refers to polygamy, a man with two wives. Now the Bible never encourages polygamy. We do find several cases in which polygamy happens, but it usually doesn't come out very well. In fact, one author said, polygamy, though practiced by some, never appears in a positive light in the Old Testament. The Bible never describes a truly happy polygamous marriage. So you men out there who are thinking about taking on another wife, I would advise not to do that. Of course, it's illegal here in America, but you could move to Saudi Arabia or something and have a few wives if you wanted to. But the Bible pattern shows that that never works out very well. But you can see the situation here. A man has two wives, and potentially the firstborn son, who's supposed to get the double inheritance, comes from the unloved wife. And so the restriction here is that you can't give that firstborn status to the son of the loved wife. Instead, you have to retain that firstborn status to the son of the unloved one. Somebody said that the husband's attitude toward his wife cannot affect his legal responsibility to her and to her children. So again, a legal responsibility. This again is protecting the woman in that case, protecting the son of the unloved wife. This is a protection of that situation. And notice the concept of firstborn pertains to both time and status. Note verse 16 again. He must not bestow the firstborn status on the son of the loved wife instead of the unloved one. So this is a status. It could be in time, the firstborn son chronologically, but somebody could take that status of the firstborn and put it on somebody else, and then he would get the double inheritance. So the firstborn son was the rightful heir of a double portion, verse 17. He shall acknowledge the son and by giving him a double portion of all that he has. So that inheritance has to be designated for the firstborn son. So the issue primarily here, other than don't get into a polygamous marriage, is inheritance and being fair with the inheritance, or impartiality, being fair and impartial. The man has to be fair to his heirs. The firstborn son deserves this double portion, and so he has to receive it. The father can't act with favoritism in this case. Of course, we're not under that obligation today. I'm the firstborn son. I have two sisters, one older and one younger, and I didn't get a double portion. I wish I had. Although the double portion of my dad's, the inheritance I got, would not be a whole lot, frankly. Even if it was doubled, it still wouldn't be much. But my dad, you know, passed away a few years ago, and we, my two sisters and I, got an inheritance. It wasn't a whole lot, but it was some. And so that was a blessing. I appreciate that. And I think really all of us, those of us who are parents, and particularly I think the men, ought to be thinking about what inheritance I'm going to leave for my kids. I believe in that idea that is so criticized today, generational wealth. I think it's a great thing if parents have enough wealth to leave something to their children. That ought to be something that men especially are considering, is leaving an inheritance to their children. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker? We are spending our children's inheritance. People down in Florida, you know, they're living it up on the inheritance that they should be setting aside for their children. Well, I think Christian parents ought to, as much as they can, leave something for their children. Like in my case, maybe it's not a lot, but it should be something. Hopefully we're not just spending everything that we have. Sometimes that's necessary, we know, given physical problems and health expenses. Maybe, you know, you'll spend everything you have and maybe you'll go into debt just to keep yourself alive at the end of your life. That is certainly happens sometimes. But all things being equal, we should try to leave an inheritance toward our children. And so inheritance issues, we know, can be a source of great conflict. You're probably aware of certain inheritance situations where there's a great conflict over who gets the inheritance and how much. How can you avoid that? Well, in today's world, it's not so much that the, you know, the firstborn son gets the double. It's more we decide how much we're going to leave to our heirs. And usually we do that through what? What's the legal instrument through which we determine how much to leave our heirs? A will. And that's a pretty good thing to work on, especially as you get a little bit older in life. And, you know, your time in this world may be coming to an end. It's a good idea to have a will so that there's not a lot of conflict over who's going to get what when it comes to your inheritance. You can take care of that, and it's a good idea to do that ahead of time. And then the third case has to do with a stubborn and rebellious son. Verses 18 through 21, a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gate of the city, and they shall say to the elders of the city, This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the many men of a city shall stone him to death with stones. So shall you put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Okay, so, you know, the fifth commandment says, honor thy father and mother. And today, maybe people don't take that all that seriously, but in the Bible, they take it very seriously. Here a man is guilty of what? Dishonoring his father and mother. He's rebellious, he's a drunkard. All these things put together show that he has a lack of respect for his mother and father. Moses describes a persistent and unrepentant rebellion of a young man against his parents. The stubborn son doesn't listen to his parents, doesn't respond to chastisement. We're not talking about young children here, by the way. This would be a young adult, probably upper teenage years, maybe early 20s, who's still living at home. He's still under his father and mother's, you know, still under their roof. And yet he's rebellious. He's stubborn. He's a glutton and a drunkard. So these young men in particular, he just mentions a boy, a man here, so I don't think they're probably talking about women, but young, well, put it in the form of a question. Are young men of this age ever rebellious? They certainly are. You get, generally speaking, for men, at least it happened to me, when you get to a certain point as a young man, you kind of feel like you need to be out on your own. And it often happens that a young man rebels against his parents. He shouldn't, certainly. But there is a sense in which the parents have to be very diligent about keeping that young man respectful and obedient until he leaves home. Once he leaves home, he establishes a new family and everything. Okay, that's fine. But while he's at home, he ought to be respectful for his parents. Well, in this case, this young, probably late teenage, early 20-year-old guy, he's stubborn, rebellious, a drunkard, and a glutton. So the parents bring this rebellious son to the elders of the city. They make these charges against him, and apparently these charges are true, and the elders of the gate, the elders of the city, recognize that this is a true charge. So this guy is a confirmed and committed evil person. An evil person in this era was called the son of Belial. This word Belial can refer to Satan. It can refer to a worthless person. He's a son of worthlessness. He's a drunkard and a glutton, just as they describe him here. And so he was dishonoring to his parents by this kind of depraved behavior. And we should recognize that parents, although we're not talking about stoning anybody in our age, in our era, still parents, I think, need to be very cautious and very proactive, very intentional about not allowing their children to be disrespectful. I think parents have to insist that their children are respectful and honor them. Now, if their children are believers, that's a lot better. It's a lot easier to convince your children to be honoring and respectful. They've accepted Christ. They put their faith and trust in Him. They have the Spirit of God within them. They should be respectful just because they're Christians. But some children are not Christians. And sometimes, sadly, parents allow their children to be disrespectful, not only by what they say, but also by what they do. I've seen many occasions from lots of different people where the parents simply allow their children to dishonor them by disobedience, and the parents don't say anything. Johnny, don't do that, don't do that. Well, he keeps on doing it, and the parents do nothing. Well, I think in certain respects, you have to demand that your children respect you by obeying you, by showing reverence. And when the child is lippy or talking back, you jump on that immediately, and you don't allow that to happen. You don't allow that to go. You have to, and I think especially with some children, you know, the strong-willed child, you have to get on that, and you have to show those children that they're not in charge and that dishonorable disrespect will not be tolerated. We don't stone children to death anymore, but we still have to deal with this, I think, very seriously. So all the city then get together against this rebel and stone him at the gate of the city. It says all the men of the city. Would that include the father? Well, he's bringing this child to the elders of his city. I don't know what it would be like for a man to try to be involved with stoning his own child, but that seems to be the indication here. And so what does that do? Verse 21 again. So shall you put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. You're putting away the evil, you're dealing with this sinful, even criminal situation, and others are going to see this and fear. That is, it's going to act as a deterrent. Other rebellious sons may look at their friend, Harold, or whoever it was, who got killed in this way, and the other rebels in the town might say, okay, that's what they do to rebellious sons. I guess I'm not going to rebel like that. I'm going to ease it back a little bit. I'm going to stay in line because I can see that this is what happens to rebel sons. Somebody said the son was ultimately rebelling against the Lord's authority and therefore attacking the foundations of the covenant community. The legislation here was not cruel, nor did it give the parents a right to abuse their children. So again, when we allow our children to be disrespectful, ultimately, they're disrespecting God. God is the authority, and God has given authority to the parents. And when the parents allow disrespect, they're fighting against God's rule. These children should be respectful, and the parents should demand that respect. We should keep that in mind for ourselves as well. And we should also, one last thing here, we should recognize that there's no biblical evidence that this was ever carried out. We don't find any example or any story that this actually happened. I don't think it probably needed to happen because the rule was involved. The rule was there, and men, young men who maybe would have rebelled, recognized that the option was there for stoning a rebellious child. Well, Moses' intent in all these rules was that they would put away the evil and do what is right in the sight of God. And so we should have that same attitude today. Whatever the circumstances are, and our circumstances are not going to be the same, but when it comes to human life, the value of human life, when it comes to family issues, inheritance issues, those types of things, we ought to be striving to do the same thing, to put away the evil from that situation and to do what is right. We should carefully follow these biblical principles pertaining to wives and children. We should be fair with our heirs. We need to be very stern with rebellious children. We should see that family matters are very serious. We ought to be very compassionate and understanding toward the outsider and the vulnerable. Like it says here, we don't treat these people brutally. We treat them with some kindness and respect, and even if it's a difficult situation that we didn't intend, a situation that's not ideal, still we treat people with respect, with fairness and compassion, especially to the weak and the vulnerable. We should be fair to all and not show favoritism. And so in your own personal relationships, think about how you can show that, how you can put away the evil and do what's right, how you can show compassion, fairness, doing what's legally right in the sight of God and in the sight of the law. The best way to purge evil and to do right is to follow God's commandments. Our situations, our conditions are different, far different from what we read about here in this text, but we can still demonstrate a high regard for human life, a regard for our families, and a regard for outsiders and those who are vulnerable. We can show compassion and be fair in how we treat people. And so our attitude and our desire ought to be exactly the same as what they're doing here, to get rid of, to put away the evil, and to do what is right in God's sight. Well, let's close in prayer.